So my name is Jonas Nielsen. I am a professor in integrated geography at the Institute of Geography and at the IRE Fieses, where I lead the research group integrated geography. I don't really know, there's 6-7 people in there. And I'm going to be presenting here, and through that you will get to know a little bit more about me and how I see the research I do. So yeah, I don't really want to spend too much time presenting myself beyond this. So with that, just good to see you and welcome to this lecture, this Fieses members lecture. And thank you all for joining here online. It's a pleasure to see you all, because we don't get to see each other enough these days. So it's nice to have some faces on screen. And it's also a pleasure to be here. I guess finally it became my time after about 7 years at IRE Fieses to actually give a members lecture. I don't know how I avoided it all those years, but now I'm here. I will just share my screen and then you can see my slides. So yeah, that's it. And as you can see, this is the title of my presentation. So what will I be doing today? I will be giving you a short overview of what I think is integrated geography. I will then exemplify this with two of my research domains. One is adaptation to climate change, and the other one is my focus on land use change. Then I will say a little bit about the theoretical implications of this work, focusing here on causal relations. And then I will be speaking about what do we do when we have some knowledge and we live in a post-truth world. And then I will be concluding with some remarks. And that's more or less the outline of the presentation. So I know that text-heavy slides is not necessarily what you want to see, and maybe even per definition bad. But I do think this text bite from Bruno Latour's latest book is very relevant for what I'm about to say today, how I work, as well as IRE Fieses at large. So I took the liberty to put it here in this piece of text and in his book in general, and in my presentation and in my work and in geography and human environment research. Is a world defined by climate change, biodiversity loss, and growing global inequality, and how these things are intimately connected. And this forces us to ask, as Latour does here, where we are. What is this place we live on, or in, or with? A place that is also more and more in control of us, as it demands something of us, and carry us along in its path, rather than simply being available for exploitation. And where the reactions of this place is increasingly challenging our existence as we know it. How do we, in such a place, distinguish between what is human, what is environment, and who has agency or power in this place? Where is it even in such a place? And how to steer this place and towards what? And who are and should be responsible for this steering? And how can this be made just? What will be the role of science in this place? For the discipline of geography and by extension, human environment research, such as the stuff we do at geography, at IRE Fieses, such questions, I think, are particularly relevant. For how can geography, when we are no longer simply on Earth or in nature, but rather intimately intertwined in each other, talk about and distinguish physical and human geography from each other, as Bruno Latour here asks, and that goes for many more disciplines as well. This, I believe, is a central question and challenge, and I think integrated geography and the stuff we do at IRE Fieses is central in this respect. But just let's take a step back and find out what I mean by integrated geography. There are obviously many different answers to this, but I would say that most integrated geography, no matter where you look, focus on the aspects I will now run through here with you. Now, the hallmark topic of most integrated geography is a geography heavily based on exploring the interactions between human beings and their biophysical environment, rather seeing them as one. And here, to a large extent in my work, followed Donna Haraway's American anthropologist, social scientist, understanding of human environment relations as kin. So we are intimately connected just as kin, to the point where the end of one of us and the beginning of the other, humans and nature, just like me and my children and your family in general, becomes very hard to establish. A point Latour also makes when he asks how we can talk about a human and physical domain in our contemporary world. As such, neither physical nor human geography is the home for how I understand integrated geography. Accordingly, I also think no particular set of methods are a priori emphasized in integrated geography. Although I, of course, have my home, as most of you know, in qualitative research, and my group here at ERIE basically work with qualitative research to a very large extent and methods, the questions we explore in my group and in integrated geography more general cannot necessarily be answered using only qualitative methods. Integrated geography doesn't belong to any particular scale either. Integrated geography can be researched done at the local, the regional, national, or global scale, or, as is actually often the case, cross-scalar. But more importantly, I think, integrated geography does not belong to a particular position on what is here called an epistemological scale continuum. Scale is equally out there, or positivist, as it is socially constructed or relative. The key questions are not that, but rather when to emphasize what understanding and how to bring different understandings of scale together. Indeed, the relevant approach, method, and scale or scales depend upon the question explored. Hence, integrated geography is also often problem-based research, i.e., it starts with a research-worthy problem and explores how this can best be addressed. Which scale is best suited, which methods, and even which approach to science, or perhaps even ontology, help us best when faced with a particular problem. This means that integrated geography, just like ERIE thesis, also often focus on putting the right teams together, the right research teams, and how to put such together, how to manage them, and how to get them to communicate on specific topics and or problems and across methodological and ontological differences is a key question in integrative geography and one that is a key question at ERIE thesis. In other words, how to get a place like ERIE thesis to work, to become more integrated across the different research domains, and particularly between the physical and social sciences that are found here. Indeed, as Latour already pointed out, this distinction makes less and less sense. Having now, albeit quite briefly, established what I mean by integrated geography, I'll try and exemplify this or illustrate how I work with these kinds of understandings in connection with climate change, adaptation research, and land use change research. Let's go to the Sahel. It's not particularly Sahelian on this slide, but what it does illustrate is some extreme climate variability experienced over the last 40, 50 years. It's been claimed to actually be the most extreme that has been quantitatively measured. So gone from very wet 50s and 60s to very dry 70s and 80s, 90s, 2000, 2010s already changing, and extremely pattern is an extreme inter-seasonal and inter-annual variability, all the trademarks of climate change. We also see that the rainfall and the seasonal rainfall has changed over time and so on and so forth. So this is some wild climate change variability, and it's unlikely and unfortunately unlikely to change in the future. Now, what does this mean for people living in these places? How do they adapt to these natural phenomena? It means a lot. This is largely because these people are subsistence farmers surviving on rain-fed agriculture. But this rain-fed agriculture does not suffice in this new climate regime, mainly because of these climatic changes. In fact, even the most productive households found in this region can only produce food lasting 4 to 6 months. And thus the people living there have had to adapt to make a living in some other way. And what you see on the slide is three of these adaptation strategies. The people there with the motorbike are just back from circular labor migration from the Ivory Coast. The picture in the middle is a focus on gardening, which is related to the picture on the right, which is development projects that come in. And often these development projects provide salaried work, which makes a big difference to support things. The people have adapted in many different ways to this lack of reliability of subsistence farming. Focusing on such livelihood strategies became my entrance into exploring how people living in a small village in northern Burkina Faso has adapted to environmental changes, as well as the social, political, economic, and environmental impacts of those adaptation strategies. Adapted livelihood strategies I document and show changed marriage, gender, and power rules, as well as tillage techniques, seeds, and irrigation methods, for example. As such, all these different aspects become part of the same research project. And to me, this is integrated geography, as human environment connections constitute the main source of research, and having this focus facilitate many different areas of exploration crossing physical and human research domains. Moreover, many of these strategies were not exclusively locally based, but also embedded in national and global processes. Global trends, like obviously climate change itself, but the global food crisis in 2008 had major impact on strategies engaged with. So did national elections, global NGOs, and multinational companies delivering seeds, as well as regional events such as the fall of Muhammad Gaddafi, which actually opened up the region to the problems we experience at the moment, Islamic movement, and has unfortunately made this region invisible and too dangerous. Depending on the diversification strategies, the villages therefore actually often jumped scale. They negotiated with development projects and national politicians, for example, trying in this way to affect how these two groups based mainly in Ouagadougou and Paris support the village and do their work there. In fact, they were really quite successful affecting processes far away. Hence, not only were the villages affected by global trends, but they also actively negated and influenced such trends. A key point is thus how the global, national, regional, and local gets mixed up in locally lived lives and vice versa, forcing us in turn to critically engage with causal relations, what causes what, outwards and inwards in space. And indeed, a relevant research question is, what exactly in such a global context is the villagers adapting to? And what are the connections between factors for their adaptation strategy? To explore such a question, I think land use change is excellent. Land use is, like adaptation to climate change, all about human environment interactions. Exploring land use change makes it possible to ask questions to people, measure spatial extent of fields, soil qualities, crop patterns, using mixed methods when trying to understand land use and cover change as a human environment. To do what I think is integrated geography, in other words. Documenting the changes is relatively easy, but, and as with adaptation to climate change, the reasons why the land use change is taking place is more difficult to establish. A major reason for this is that land use change is often characterized by a decoupling of production and consumption, i.e. we cannot explain the change from rice to banana fields in northern Laos simply by a local change of diets. It's not as if all the farmers just began to eat bananas. Indeed, such a change, when looked at, like many other land use changes around the world, is found embedded in regional, national, and global trends. And let me exemplify by staying here in northern Laos. There, a change, as just mentioned, from rice to banana fields were observed. Exploring why, we discovered that a number of flows originating often far away manifested themselves in the fields around the village studied. Indeed, it turned out that, for example, a conflict in the South China Sea between China and the Philippines had implications for our fields, as this conflict resulted in a ban by China of importing banana from the Philippines. Coinciding with this event was a national Chinese policy emphasizing that senior citizens had to eat one banana a day. We also saw hurricanes in other areas of the around the Philippines. We saw pest outbreak in the Latin American banana fields, and all these kinds of things manifested in fields we're looking at northern Laos, as did cross-border ethnic relations between Chinese and Lao villages. This really facilitated this move of Chinese farmers onto Lao land. There was also a number of discourses at a national level in Laos. For example, modernization for cash crops, local aspiration for cash for consumer goods, which could be fulfilled by growing banana, and environmental degradation just across the border in China, making growing bananas there difficult. In combination with this and many other factors, what we saw was the banana boom. Now, capturing these causal relations was facilitated by the work I've been doing with my research group around telecoupling. Explaining telecouplings is beyond my time frame here, but it's essentially a heuristic or a way of thinking aimed at viewing land use changes systemically, highlighting that land use changes are often caused by processes taking place across large distances and often with spillover effects that needs to be incorporated into explanations and consequences of a particular land use change. As such, what we are doing with telecouplings is really try to break down globalization in order to make such an analysis manageable by dividing the processes involved in a land use change into sending, receiving, and spillover systems connected by flows of people, materials, information, technology, discourses, policies, and so on and so forth. Indeed, in this optic, the banana fields of northern Laos was a spillover effect of political conflicts between China and the Philippines. And we can have many more analyses like that. Similarly, and that's captured in the top figure there, the deforestation in the Chaco region of South America can be seen as a spillover effect of rising consumption of pork in China, causing the European Union to increase their production of this type of meat. These pork, these pigs, they need soybeans, so that results in increasing soybean imports from the Chaco, causing an expansion of soy fields there into dry forests. Now, this story then feeds back into the European Union, causing in turn concern and flows of policies the other way, aimed, for example, at halting this deforestation or supporting farmers or whatever. In this way, the telecoupling framework incorporates various and very different actors, scales, and spheres of research when wanting to explain a particular land use. And as such, it opens up for my understanding of integrated geography, as no flow, no scale, no actor, no method is a priori emphasized. Rather, this is an empirical question based upon the problem needing an explanation. I want now to highlight the research challenges that I see emerging from these fields. And I think the issue of causality is here crucial. How do we, in the examples just highlighted, deal with the complexity of drivers of change? Which of these are most important for the observed changes and actions? Where do they come from? How do they interact? How are they mediated? When do we have enough drivers, or when is our explanation strong enough? How do we ascribe system boundaries? How do we close our unit of analysis in a world or in a research field where we're exploring globalization? And how do we avoid the holistic trap where we say everything is connected to everything? These, I think, are open questions when we study globalization, but still want to be specific. Answering such questions is, for this reason, not just an academic exercise, but also often deeply intertwined in issues around social and environmental sustainability. We cannot, in my opinion, this is why I work with the heuristic of telecoupling, simply just conclude complexity or fall into the trap of everything being connected to everything, the holistic trap, as is, in my opinion, often done in research on globalization. We should strive to arrive, and this is difficult, at identifiable and measurable connections and descriptions about such process, so we can identify the most important actors, policies, companies, behaviors, and the flows that these interact in, so that we as academics can help steer global connections towards more sustainable outcomes. We need, in other words, to be able to ascribe causality and dare to operationalize these academic insights for sustainability. And this might require swallowing some camels here and there. This, and now the talk will take a little bit of a twist, is, I think, perhaps paradoxically, a process challenged by academia itself. Now, half a century ago, and especially during the 1980s and 1990s, social science and humanities, including human geography, played an extremely important role in critical scholarship, showing how analytic categories we take for granted as universal truths, like gender, did not necessarily exist in other times and places, exposing how such categories were created and actually often used by elites to exercise power, exposing how language or culture, if you like, and the way we understand reality is intimately connected, challenge not only societal givens like gender roles, but also established beliefs and scientific panaceas or universal scientific truth. Knowledge was shown to be situated in time and place, not something necessarily objectively established or given. Now, this resulted in a much needed erosion of beliefs in certainties of positivistic science. And indeed, deconstruction, which is the term capturing this work, remained a vital, don't get me wrong, an important aspect of academic work. No science, no society is served by naive realism. However, deconstruction has proved to be kind of double-edged. A climate of relativism, skepticism, and cynicism has resulted, for sure not only because of this, but also because of this, and let's look inwards, and have installed in us as academics, to use the words of the French intellectual Bernard-Henri Lévy, an obsessively modest way of thinking that makes uncertainty our last words almost always. Listen to any researcher speaking in media, for example. Reducing interpretations of reality to mere narratives, discourses, and social constructs, true as this might be, has been argued quite strongly in the literature to be instrumental for today's generalized skepticism towards academic work. As such, deconstruction, initially conceived as a healthy critique to established ideas, have now come to be exploited by the status quo, to, for example, discredit or simply doubt the whole science behind climate change, as well as mass connections between environmental destruction and economic growth. These are just narratives which much uncertainty attach. Or, to put it differently, narratives that you can somehow choose or not choose to believe in. Decades devoted to this deconstruction has in a way paved the way for a golden era of relativism, post-truth, or the moment we currently find ourselves in, defined by the disappearance of shared objective standards for truth and the undifferentiated blurring of facts, values, knowledge, opinions, or belief, or my opinion is as good as your knowledge kind of arguments, may be looked at as the Frankenstein of this epistemological drift. Indeed, as Frankfurt in this excellent small book that I can really highly recommend already in 2005 argued, the contemporary proliferation of bullshit has deeper sources in various forms of skepticism, which deny that we can have any reliable access to an objective reality. But we do know something, we can approach, we do know things, right? Obviously we do. We know, for example, to stay within the field of human-environment relations or integrated geography, if you like, that there are ecologic and environmental limits, real, objective and measurable limits. We also know that crossing these will lead to abrupt change or even collapse. This has been empirically demonstrated across local and regional scales. There is also, and to take another example, although this is an example of the opposite, i.e. we have no empirical evidence, we know this whatsoever, for the claim that green growth is even possible. Or, and as argued by the eco-modernist and basically every politician, that continued growth, economic growth, is comparable with sustainability, because technological progress and substitution of natural resources would lead us somehow to a dematerialized and decarbonized economy where growth is decoupled from resource use and pollution. This thesis or idea lacks empirical grounding, and there is currently no evidence supporting a decoupling of economic growth from environmental pressures on anywhere near the scale needed to deal with environmental breakdown. And when evidence is presented, to the best of my knowledge, say at a regional or national scale, it is often due to an outsourcing of production and pollution. Denmark, for example, has just realized that 10-15% of their CO2 emissions actually takes place in China. And this, they realize, needs to be calculated if the Danes want to claim to have reduced our emissions. And obviously China is not the only place that Denmark outsourced to. In fact, outsourcing often go to developing countries with lower working and environmental standards. This, I think, is a point again that the telecoupling framework can help capture, highlighting the importance of tracing causal relations in a systemic and global way, identifying the flows, the actors, the outcomes, and potential solutions, including the spillover effects. My point is that we need to show this, remind the politicians of the facts, or to put it differently, claim terrain as academics, and that we, to my opinion, in geography and our thesis, are particularly well placed to claim this terrain. Why? Well, because we are integrative. We do not belong, should not belong to either the natural sciences or the social sciences or the humanities. We teach our students in our graduate program that truth is both constructed and measurable, that the forest, here a painting of ours, is equally a social construct as it is a collection of trees in close proximity to each other. It can be both. That in geography and at IREFESIS, I would claim a forest can be deconstructed as well as objectively measured. And that is really a strong position to be. Because we need to be able to deconstruct, take the lessons we have learned from that, and deconstruct dominant narratives such as the belief in green growth, or for example, that Denmark can reduce its emission by 70% by 2030 without thinking systemically, including outsourcing spillovers. And we need to do this deconstruction, not just for its own sake, but by providing objective scientific data, exemplifying and supporting our deconstructions or arguments, as well as provide solutions. Deconstructions cannot, even if we provide the data, be the end point. We need to show how the forest is both constructed and measurable. We need to highlight that deconstruction for its own sake is not productive, nor is the production of data. For data and science in a post-truth era no longer simply speaks for itself. We need to show that bringing this together is powerful, and this is what I believe geography and our thesis can do. And in this paper, I think we exemplify exactly this. We show how there is no, to our knowledge, evidence in current scientific literature supporting a decoupling of economic growth from environmental pressures. We then conduct a discourse analysis of all major environmental policies since the early 1970s, showing how these, despite lack of evidence, continue to advocate green growth. We then show how this reflects dominant political and economic structures, i.e. we deconstruct these policies and challenge the universal accepted truth of economic growth. Give me a more current dominant narrative. In fact, and of course, supporting by the literature, we show how economic growth is directly related to the loss of biodiversity. It also focused this paper on human-environment relations. It has human and physical geographers of people working together. It is teamwork, and it deals with a real-world challenge. And set the team, the use of methods, and the scale addressed accordingly. As such, the paper also illustrates, I think, many aspects of what I think integrated geography is. But we do one more thing. We recommend actions based on these insights. We take, in other words, a position. We believe in this paper we have both an obligation, but also a position from which to do this. We are not very modest, nor very relative, or particularly uncertain. Concretely, we argue that if the science is correct, and we normally are, we should consider alternatives to economic growth or biodiversity policies beyond economic growth, unless, of course, we do not care about biodiversity. Indeed, and this is something I believe is becoming increasingly apparent, research need to become more engaged with providing not only solutions, but also political and normative suggestions for societal transformation towards sustainability. We need to say things like, if we believe biodiversity has value, then consider this or that. For example, whether economic growth is the most important thing in life. Global climate change, biodiversity loss, and social inequality is something we daily document, describe, and analyze. This is not relative, nor is it situated knowledge. It is real, objectively measurable, and it is happening fast. Thus, more than ever, we need scientific knowledge about how to deconstruct the narratives and the so-called truth facilitating these three processes, as well as the objective knowledge supporting or enabling such deconstructions in the first place. And this, to me, is a fact that is potentially depressing, but also very demanding and super motivating at the same time. Indeed, even the master of situated knowledge, how the production of science is connected to social structure, Bruno Latour urges us in this book, as cited in the beginning, as scientists and citizens to get the hell back down to earth and in the new climate regime, get on with things. We as researchers need, in my opinion, to become more formative. This means for the field of integrated geography that we as scientists should not only do research, this goes for your thesis as well, on sustainability, but also for sustainability. Not only on biodiversity, but also for biodiversity. And we can multiply these examples. Think of your own research. We need to more radically engage in ongoing deliberations in policy and practice arenas about how to transform our insights into actionable solutions for sustainable transformation. As such, I understand normativity as a process, not as an endpoint. I don't want to define for the world what should be. where being normative includes or involves a continued reflection on what is normative about as well as in our research. Concretely, I argue that this can be achieved by identifying the different values and perspectives that underlie our research. Values that we all have if we are at IREFISES, such as wanting healthy ecosystems, that's a normative position, valuing biodiversity, social justice, equitable distributions of costs and benefits, the right to food sovereignty, etc., etc. You all have them, they all drive your research. So consider how you can change from research on such topics to research for such topics. Identify these, consider them, will help us also identify the arenas and stakeholders to take these insights into. This should then be followed by exploring our assumption regarding how best to achieve it, how best to get to our normative values and perspective. If it is, for example, food sovereignty, is organic agriculture the way to go? Which option, practices, or systems are best achieved to achieve solutions that we want to find? And why do we advocate these? And what is in the way of achieving it? How do we, for example, best achieve sovereignty? If we in this way make normativity a part of our research, we should be, I think, in a much better position to identify or discuss what should be the key research questions of a normative agenda. While this is important in its own sake, it is also an important point for IREFISES. Why? Because developing research questions under the umbrella of normative questions, such as how can meat consumption be reduced? How can supply chains be made more sustainable for ecologies and people? And how can healthy and affordable cities be achieved? Open up for collaboration across many divides, many research fields within IREFISES. They're problem-based questions that might indeed achieve what we want to do. They are questions that start with a problem or challenge, asking us to identify how best to address them. As such, they immediately reject prior commitments to scale, methods, post-positivist or reflexive science. They throw us into human environment research and relations, taking as a premise that there's no one that just lives on Earth or in nature, as Bruno Latour in the beginning reminded us. They also involve culture, structure, agency, biophysical aspects, and cross-scalar relations. They, in other words, result in research where it does not make sense to think in social and natural science. Because what is that when, and as Latour and Haraway argues, we are kin, so intimately connected to each other that splitting us apart is meaningless. They take us to research with contemporary relevance and meaning, but also one with a motivation and responsibility to engage. And this is a powerful combination. This is integrated geography as our understanding, spanning research and science policy domains. It is geography as I've been part of it here and at IREFISES. And a geography I most certainly want to remain part of, as well as help develop. For we all live together, global lives. Amadou and Fatimata and their kids on the savannah in northern Burkina Faso, as well as Sarah and I and our kids here in northern Europe. We are intimately connected on this one planet. We are kin on and with it and with each other. That increasingly reminds us of this, the planet. It comes back at us. Science, engaging with this understanding, as well as how to bring solution forward, is what is needed. That is all I wanted to say. Thank you.